Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. John Kenneth Galbraith helped build the New Deal and the 20th century America that grew on its legacy. Now, the house he built is under heavy fire. His ideas about government's role in society and the economy from Social Security on are being marked for demolition by hardline opponents in the Bush administration. Tonight, we'll take a second look at Galbraith's vision for America through a new biography and ask whether that vision is passing or due for a rebirth. This hour, On Point, John Kenneth Galbraith and the fate of the New Deal's legacy in the era of George W. Bush. But first tonight, we begin in New York, where former WorldCom CEO Bernard Ebbers took the stand today for the second straight day in his trial. Prosecutors charge Ebbers knew about the $11 billion accounting fraud that brought the giant telecom firm down 3 years ago. Ebbers insists he was an unknowing onlooker. Joining me now from New York is Brooke Masters. She's a financial reporter for The Washington Post and has been covering the trial. Brooke, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So what's the case that Bernie Ebbers is making on his second day on the stand?
Well, today was cross-examination, which means that Bernie Ebbers' story now gets attacked by prosecutors, and he has to face their questions.
How's he holding up?
He's having a rough time. He hasn't, you know, disintegrated, but prosecutors have been very tough. They, you know, show him documents that show that the company's operating expenses are swinging wildly from, you know, $600 million one quarter is just simply gone in the next. And they say, you know, why didn't you notice? And he has had to say to document after document, I didn't see it, I didn't read it, I didn't notice.
Is it sounding credible?
It's a tough one. You know, I don't know, frankly. It's, you know, they haven't caught him in a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't caught him with a document that shows he definitively knew. There isn't a smoking gun. The repeated denials are tough, and I think the jury was getting sort of tired of them.
Brooke, remind us of the scale of what is alleged to have gone on at WorldCom.
Well, WorldCom was the nation's second largest long-distance company when this went down. And in June of 2002, they revealed that for the previous 7 quarters, which means way back into 2000, they had been inflating their earnings and their revenue growth basically by taking line costs, which are the fees they pay to other carriers, which are a huge part of their operating expenses, and taking millions and millions of dollars each quarter, adding up to billions, and just pretending they were capital expenditures, which is what you know, when you're investing in something, you build a building, that's a capital expenditure.
And they looks just a lot better at the bottom line that way.
Exactly. What it did, it basically, in a number of quarters, shifted them from a money-losing company to a money earning company.
And we're talking billions and billions here, as Carl Sagan might say. Bernie Ebbers essentially mounted a know-nothing defense yesterday. I didn't know. I'm not a trained accountant.
Absolutely. The New York tabloids are calling it the Sergeant Schultz defense after the Hogan's Heroes character.
I know nothing.
Absolutely. He is, you know, I had heart trouble. I was disengaging. You know, I just didn't know this wasn't my area. I focused on other things.
What's at stake for Mr. Ebbers here? If this goes against him, is it going to be out as fast as you can say Martha Stewart?
Absolutely not. If the sentencing guidelines were still mandatory, he was looking at 25 years probably. They're not mandatory, so he may be able to get some sort of reduction. But, you know, he's certainly looking at much of the rest of his natural life. He's 63 years old.
Wow, that gray beard could be white before he walks out if it goes that way. How much longer will the trial go on?
I think we're reaching the home stretch. The prosecutors finished their cross-examination today, so Ebbers will take the stand again tomorrow for what's called redirect, where his lawyer gets to kind of try and fix things. And I don't think there are a huge number of witnesses to come. It is possible, although not likely, that the case could get to the jury as soon as the end of this week. I think it's more likely next week.
Well, it will be fascinating in that jury room. We won't be there, but a big decision coming up. Brooke Masters, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Brooke Masters, financial reporter for The Washington Post. She spoke with me from New York. You didn't have to study economics to know the name John Kenneth Galbraith. His reach goes far beyond the classrooms of Harvard. From the New Deal to World War II to the affluent society and the internet bubble, he's been an advisor, formal or informal, to every Democratic president since FDR. He campaigned with Adlai Stevenson, was JFK's economic advisor and ambassador to India, and fell famously out of favor with LBJ for criticizing the war in Vietnam. With more than 7 million of his dozens of books sold, he can claim to be the most widely read economist of the 20th century. Today, at 96, Galbraith remains the great lion of liberalism. But his view of the world is marked for teardown by conservative supporters of the Bush administration. In a new biography, Richard Parker gets up close and very personal with one of the country's great minds and perhaps passing visions. This hour, On Point, John Kenneth Galbraith and the fate of the New Deal's legacy in the era of George W. Bush. Listeners, you can join the conversation. Is George Bush's ownership society on its way to becoming the new New Deal? Is the American political culture fundamentally hostile to New Deal-style government intervention in the economy? Or is Galbraith's worldview due for a comeback? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Richard Parker, lecturer in public policy and senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center, at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. His new book, and it's a big one and a great one, is John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. Richard Parker, thank you for being with us tonight.
Tom, I'm delighted to be here with you.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack. Good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Richard.
Hello, Jack. How are you?
So, Richard Parker, take us in here. We've got this great moment. The whole country's staring at it with the Social Security debate, and if the Bush folks have their way, that's just the beginning of a kind of enormous turnaround, it seems, to just veer off of the whole New Deal kind of path. The idea the government could intervene, could play a role, could engineer to take the hard edges off of the free market, to make society and the economy work better. I mean, I'm just a layman, but that has always seemed to me like something near the heart of what John Kenneth Galbraith laid out. Is his life's work, his life vision now kind of on the chopping block?
Well, I think the Republicans have put it on the chopping block, but I think, in fact, for most Americans, it's more important than ever before. John Kenneth Galbraith is not an ideologue of government against business. He is an advocate of balance between government and business, and his conviction is that for the last 30 years, that balance has gone badly awry. It's not just George W. It goes back to George's father, and it goes back to Ronald Reagan.
Now, he was, as you say, maybe the most famous economist living today, was and is, 96, what, six, a towering man, 6 feet.
8 inches tall.
8 inches tall. I've seen him at airports, I don't remember, London or Paris. I mean, he stands out in a crowd and still does. Remind us of his origins. This is not a guy who was born in the shadow of the Ivy League.
No, by no means. He was from a middle, lower middle class farm family in southern Ontario.
He's a Canadian,
Was a Canadian born. He's been an American citizen since the late 1930s, mm-hmm. but still very attached to Canada. He was educated in a one-room school. He went to high school in a completely nondescript little rural high school, and then he shipped off for not 4 but 5 years to study animal husbandry at Ontario Agricultural College, which he once referred to as the worst university in the English-speaking language.
After they gave him an honorary degree, his arrogance could be legendary, but maybe it wasn't much of a school.
Well, I don't think it was much of a school then. I think it's a different school now. He did, in fact, get an honorary degree in the 1960s and said just what I quoted, which is he referred to it as the worst school in the English university in the English-speaking language.
Ouch.
When he was then predictably attacked by alumni and administration of the school, he backed down characteristic Galbraith fashion. He said, well, perhaps he was wrong. Perhaps Arkansas A&M was worse, but he wasn't sure that they spoke English.
Oh, thanks a lot. Got his PhD in economics at Berkeley.
He did, yeah.
And he's always been called the economist for non-economists, and that not exactly a compliment from the world of economists, which has gone much more toward metrics, numbers, equations than Galbraith. He was kind of the humanist of 20th century economists.
Well, he was the living connection to an old older tradition in economics. And, of course, his great mentor and the mentor of most of his generation was John Maynard Keynes, who himself was a brilliant economist, but who couldn't be caught using equations unless a gun was placed to his head. He thought that the math would mislead theoretical economists like himself or ultimately like Galbraith from looking at what the real questions were. So Galbraith stands on one side of a very important 20th century divide. There's no question about that.
And what is the core of the Galbraith view of the world that you see, the Bush crew now looking to take down?
Well, I think there are several parts to it. Let me say what the first is, which is balance between government and the private sector. Galbraith in the Affluent Society famously sketched out what he saw America becoming in the 1950s, which was a nation of public affluence, of private affluence and public squalor. That is, a nation in which we had these extraordinary Cadillac high tail finned vehicles and the expansive suburbs that were growing up at the time and markets and shopping malls that were exploding in number. And at the same time, we didn't have the money for good schools. We didn't have the money for good parks or good health or any of a variety of public goods that were needed.
So hold that as at least a part of the kernel, private splendor and public squalor. Jack Beatty, Galbraith, very long shadow, but a shadow that the Republican right would walk straight away from.
Yes, I think there's no question about it, and partly because he's so right, and that is he can put things in almost aphoristic form that make his thought seem lapidary, carved in stone. He's very hard to it's very hard to refute a man who can say something like, let me quote, "If a man seeks to design a better mousetrap, he is the soul of enterprise. If he seeks to design a better society, he is a crackpot." That is a brilliant, brilliant observation.
That puts it in some perspective. We're talking tonight with Richard Parker. He's the biographer of John Kenneth Galbraith, his life, his politics, his economics, looking at Galbraith and the fate of the New Deal's legacy in the era of George W. Bush. You can join the conversation tonight. Is Galbraith's view that government should intervene to push for a more perfect world out of date? And will market forces get us there faster all on their own? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the economist John Kenneth Galbraith and the fate of the New Deal's legacy in America in the era of George W. Bush. My guest tonight is Richard Parker. He is author of the authorized biography, a lot of cooperation from Mr. Galbraith here, John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. You can join the conversation tonight. Is George Bush's ownership society on its way to becoming the New Deal? And are you ready to jettison the legacy of the New Deal, to move on? Or is that throwing out hard-won wisdom? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We want to hear from the great man himself for a moment here tonight. In March of 2002, a couple years back now, we visited John Kenneth Galbraith at his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in the shadow of Harvard, where he taught for many, many years. We sat down and took the microphone over, sat down and talked with him. We've got a little bit of his voice here to bring it to life tonight. It's still very much alive, of course, but let's hear it. Here is, from March 2002, Galbraith railing against income inequality and tax breaks that are given to the wealthiest Americans.
The best economy is the one which treats everybody as much alike as their personal contribution allows. We have a bad distribution of income, which could be a frail point for the system as a whole. I'm not pessimistic, but I don't think we should ever lose sight of the fact that the good economy is one that has a generally equitable reward for all of its participants.
John Kenneth Galbraith, in an interview we did with him in 2002, he's still going strong. We're joined by his biographer tonight, Richard Parker. Richard Parker, I wish you'd lay out for us. We've had so many economists on this show. Milton Friedman been on not so very long ago, and feeling just pretty marvy these days. Not everything in the Bush agenda going exactly the way he'd like, but overall, in the great contest of worldviews, of views of economists, sounding like he felt he'd come out on top here. I wish you'd sort of paint the great battle lines here and place, I don't know, maybe Galbraith and Friedman as if they work as the two poles.
Absolutely. They work perfectly as the two poles, and they've been debating between one another for the last 55 years. Look, I mean, I'm always confounded by conservatives, at least in the last 30 years. I grew up among conservatives in Southern California, so the whole libertarian new conservatism is not unfamiliar to me. But let's take a couple of premises of new conservatism, hallmarks of what they think is success. Limited government.
Mm-hmm.
How big was government under Lyndon Johnson and John F. Kennedy as a percentage of the total GDP? The answer is over 30%.
Mm.
How big is it today under George Bush? Over 30%. There has been no decline in the government's share of gross domestic product in the last 40 years. So where the conservatives think that they're making great gains is beyond me. Second, in terms of fiscal responsibility, unbelievable that they can claim that they're making headway in achieving a world of fiscal responsibility when this president is about to chalk up a $500 billion deficit in 1 year. He's running $500 billion trade deficits. And under Republican presidents since Reagan's election, we've added something like $7 trillion to the public debt, more than all presidents since the beginning of the Republic under George Washington. Is this Republican success?
Okay, we hear the fire in the belly. We acknowledge that Richard Parker, co-founder of Mother Jones, magazine, so we know where you're coming from. But still, I wish we get that. But you're surely not saying that Milton Friedman and John Kenneth Galbraith represent the same worldview, despite these outcomes that you're pointing
out. No, I don't think they represent
the
same worldview
lines
at all. The idea is there are two different worldviews, but Milton Friedman is claiming victory when he hasn't changed Galbraith's world in some ways. The change that has moved in Friedman's direction is the change in income and wealth distribution over the last 30 years. We're now at a point in American history where the income and wealth distribution of the country resembles America under Calvin Coolidge and Herbert Hoover. Again, it's striking to me that Republicans consider this victory. They do, of course. They don't highlight this. They focus on the so-called cultural issues like abortion and so on. But you know, if I were they, I'd focus on that, too, because I sure wouldn't want to run on what they've done to income and wealth distribution in the United States.
Okay. Jack Beatty, I'm going to turn to you here. You hear what Richard Parker points to. I've heard you point to some of the same things. And yet, there's a change here that's more than just income distribution. The public understanding of the way the country ought to go, the basic kind of philosophy that best governs the country, seems, to my observation, to have changed a lot since it was behind FDR in the very early days of Galbraith.
Well, you can mark the change this way. In 1964, in the Republican primaries, Barry Goldwater talked about pretty much doing away with the Social Security system. Well, the Democrats pretty much destroyed him with that, plus his insouciance about nuclear war. In the 2000 campaign, George Bush talked about privatizing Social Security. He talked about it again in 2004. He touched the third rail, and you know what? He won both times. So I think that is a change. The day when you could talk about destroying the system as it is, essentially putting you're dead on arrival with Barry Goldwater in 1964, George Bush, it's the center of his second term. So that is a change, it seems to me, in the political culture.
And of course, there's been an enormous change in the country's readiness to get rid of regulation and go back to that kind of free market faith. Let's go back to Galbraith himself again in March of 2002, here talking about him saying that government regulation of business is often necessary. He says those who oppose it do so not out of principle but out of self-interest, yet it's happened. Let's listen.
People who find a regulation inconvenient never say it. That's why they're against it, or very rarely. What they say is that it's socially bad, that it's socially inappropriate, that it's socially restrictive and depression-making. And we had an outbreak of that in recent times, and it did two things. It removed regulations that might have been appropriate in the case of something like Enron. And it justified the keeping and the position of those who are doing well.
There, John Kenneth Galbraith, and the keeping of the time in his living room in 2002, saying, hang on to regulation if those voices against it are really just voices of self-interest. And yet Richard Parker coming to this change in national perception. Galbraith went from being kind of at the heart of national policymaking to really at the margins within the last few decades.
That's absolutely right, but let me challenge you on a couple of points here, Tom. First is, have we moved to a state of lower regulation? No. I mean, most people who study regulation recognize that we've created new domains of regulation, the environment being the principal one. Compared to the 1970s, we have vastly more regulation than we did in terms of the environment. So while we may have given up certain kinds of regulation in sectoral industrial fields like airplanes or buses or trucks or banking, we've substituted new regulation. Take for example, the President Bush's recent drug prescription law passed last fall. You'll notice that the government regulates itself by not allowing Medicare to bid competitively for the lowest cost drugs. Mm-hmm. This is not about abandoning regulation. This is about a different kind of regulation whose beneficiaries are concentrated much more than they were under the old New Deal model. The choice has never been more or less regulation. It's the mix of regulation and who benefits. Cui bono.
And yet I'm still trying to haul the spotlight out here on what's change, and you're surely not saying that everything has gone along just as Galbraith imagined that it might, that it's still fundamentally under some kind of Republican cloak driven by the same impetus that it was. That's not – I hear you saying that the income distribution has changed, is changing, but it's more than just income distribution, isn't it? I mean, this isn't the same New Deal country going along. George Bush wants to begin to privatize Social Security, and you know there are people around him who would like to completely throw it out.
Oh, sure. Look, I mean, but again, you made the point earlier, which is – Jack made the point, which is that this has been around among Republicans since 1964. George Bush was advocating privatization in 1978. The idea that the Republicans have come and begun to represent a vast new majority in America is wildly wrong. I mean, we had two of the closest races in presidential history in 2000 and 2004, and as I recollect, George Bush lost in 2000 in the popular vote. We have a country that's cutting out right now at a knife's edge, and when you do survey research, you don't find anything like an overwhelming majority of Americans saying, let's privatize Social Security.
The White House, the Senate, the House of Representatives, a majority of state governments. I mean, we all saw what the presidential vote was. But when you look at where the and we've also seen Republicans dragging their feet out the car door now on the Social Security
change.
And yet, I say again, since 1964, a lot has changed.
Oh, absolutely. Look, I'm not arguing that a lot hasn't changed. I think you were trying to focus me in a direction that I didn't want to go because I wanted to make a couple of points about what has changed dramatically, and it's not what the Republicans have promised would be the change. Mm. Government hasn't gotten smaller. Deficits haven't disappeared. Income distribution and prosperity for all has not emerged from their policies. Now, to the degree that things have changed, what's changed is that the shift of white Southerners out of the Democratic Party into the Republican Party has destroyed the ability of the Democrats to enjoy the kind of overwhelming majority that they had in the White House and the Congress in 1964. There's no question about that.
I want to turn right now to another voice joining us from Chicago, Austin Goolsbee, professor of economics at the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business. Austin Goolsbee, thank you for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
So there you are at the University of Chicago, which was the great alternate pole, thought pole to the world of Galbraith. How do you look back on his legacy and what's turning in the world right now with George Bush and a Republican majority in Washington?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting because there's two ways to look at it. I think in some ways the Galbraith legacy has not held up as well because it got sort of pinched from two sides. One was in the popular mind, there was the emergence of Milton Friedman and kind of the conservative alternative to big government.
Mm-hmm.
But then within the profession of economics, Galbraith's legacy was not what it might have been because, in some sense, the revolution of Paul Samuelson and the analytic economists coming in and saying, hey, well, let's get the data, let's run statistics, let's build models. And Galbraith is really the last of the literary types, so his figure's been a bit diminished because he kind of got pinched from those two sides.
As a literary type and a great one among economists, do you see him having a lasting impact on economic thinking?
I kind of don't. I do quite enjoy many of his books. As you say, he may be the best writer that economics ever produced. And if you just go back and read, you know, his book on 1929 and the Great Crash, it's really very interesting. It's compelling reading. He didn't really invent, however, any kind of, I don't know if you would call it machinery. He didn't invent analytic tools that the profession, the social scientists would turn to, nor did he really create a different mode of thinking that led to a great popular movement, if you will. So I think he remains a little more in the area of inspiration. So if you're coming at it things from a kind of a left-wing point of view, you read him and you say, hey, a lot of the issues that he was talking about remain issues today. But anything specific, if you start looking at it, a lot of them, most of them probably just don't hold up very well.
And again, you're at Chicago. This was the other camp. But how do you read what's happened? Has the Milton Friedman poll won? The market forces poll won? Has Galbraith been, in the end, vanquished?
A little bit. You know, in some ways, it swung very far in one direction. And you would have said if it were 15 or 20 years ago, you would have said he was completely vanquished. I think the pendulum has swung back somewhat, and certainly some of the topics that he discussed, like the propensity to speculation and the propensity of
the things that make the Great Crash in 29,
yeah,
or Internet and Bernie Ebbers, as we heard, the scandals,
yeah,
the propensity to market forces not keep everything vertical, upright, on the upright.
Yeah, so I think in those kinds of things, that's why I say he's kind of an inspiring figure, less an analytical figure. So that's why I think his impact on economic thinking is maybe not as great. It's almost like he's sort of H.G. Wells, who would write these science fiction books predicting the rise of an air force, predicting travel to the moon and things like this. And you can look back and say, oh, wasn't that interesting that he was talking about things that did end up happening? But you really wouldn't turn to him if you said, well, we want to send a spaceship to the moon. Let's go get H.G. Wells' blueprint
to design
for what the spaceship should be. Yeah.
Richard Parker, how do you see that? Galbraith, famously not the guy for analytic tools. In fact, that great wing of economics kind of turned away from him, yet a great interpreter of economics and society. So in the end, who comes out closer to, I don't know, to truth, to reality?
I think you have to unpack several things here, because in fact a lot of post-Second World War economics intimidated the general public into failing to ask questions about how successful it was at the core role that a science has, which is in prediction. Austin and I both know that Chicago is famous for probably three major theoretical contributions in the last 30 years: monetarism and Milton Friedman, rational expectations and Bob Lucas, and then Arthur Laffer and supply side. I don't know whether Austin feels the same way I do, but it's hard for me to see where any of those three looks like it is going to survive as a pillar of economic understanding. Friedman himself no longer feels that monetarism has great analytic power, and nowhere is monetarism being practiced by any central bank authority. So that's issue number one. Which is, Chicago represents a certain kind of conservative application of the toolbox that modern economics has brought. The second question is, how successful has the toolbox been at creating an understanding of the workings of the modern economy? And part of my argument would be, it hasn't done as good a job as the generation that trained me back in the 1960s, the Solos and the Samuelsons and the like. Austin's, I think, a few years younger than I am, but did get a PhD at MIT and certainly must have encountered those great figures that were my heroes. But, I mean, look at the issue of growth theory. What is the growth theory that dominates economic thinking? What is trade theory that dominates economic thinking today? The fact of the matter is there is a body of tools, but that don't cohere into a workable, broad theory that actually counters Galbraith's.
Austin Goolsbee, I know we just got you half a minute. Here, the biographer of Galbraith says you've got the analytics, but they're not working.
Well, I'd say two things. Look, the Samuelson and Solo, who he mentions, they were explicitly rejecting the legacy of Galbraith. They absolutely believed in using the analytic tools. They aren't conservative, but they weren't following Galbraith's lead.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I would say is, if you start looking at Galbraith's actual contributions, what does he say? He's a strong advocate, for example, of permanent price controls. When you actually look at the details of what he advocated, in many cases, they're just obviously wrong. That's not to say he's not an inspiring figure. It's just that a lot of the details, he got them wrong.
Chicago still pushing back. Austin Goolsbee at the University of Chicago, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Jack Beattie, I've got to get your view on this in just a minute. First, a short break. We're talking tonight about John Kenneth Galbraith and the fate of the New Deal's legacy in the era of George W. Bush. Richard Parker is with us, biographer of John Kenneth Galbraith. You can join the conversation as well. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the economist John Kenneth Galbraith and the fate of the New Deal's legacy in the era of George W. Bush. My guest tonight, Richard Parker, biographer of Galbraith. The new book is John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. You can join the conversation tonight. Why is the Milton Friedman conservative economic crowd on top today? Are they more realistic or are they irresistible utopians? In 1952, Galbraith said, liberals hadn't had a new idea in 20 years. Do they have a new idea, a chance today? And is Galbraith history, or is he due for a comeback? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Bob's calling from Livonia, Michigan. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Okay. My comment, I guess, is that I've always associated Galbraith with Keynesian economics.
Yes.
One is I'd like to know if there was a close association there. And secondly, I sort of see the death of Keynesian economics, at least as far as the media is concerned. For example, we attribute the stimulation of the economy due to tax cuts rather than to the massive deficits that both Reagan and Bush generated.
So in the way it's presented.
The tax cut is lost in... my question is Keynesian economics still alive? And secondly, why isn't it referred to? I do have one thing I would also in connection
yes, please,
with
Bob.
That. Milton Friedman, I think highly of. Now, I don't think the analytical underpinnings of supply side economics, on the other hand, is from a mathematical point of view, is that well verified.
And Richard Parker is himself saying here tonight, not really holding up. Bob, let us pick that up. Richard Parker, take us back. You've got all this great history, and we're just barely touching it tonight.
Sure.
But remind us how Keynes came on the scene, how Galbraith picked up his thinking and ran with it. What did it mean for the country?
Sure.
And then to Bob's point, are we still, is that gone? Is that vanquished? Or are we still effectively operating on a Keynesian model?
Right. John Maynard Keynes publishes this book, The General Theory, in the middle of the 1930s, where the Western world is in the midst of a titanic recession called the Great Depression. The standard argument, the so-called neoclassical theory of economics, says that the solution when you have a downturn like that is to cut wages further, cut investment further, cut spending further until a new low-level equilibrium is reached, and then the market will gradually restore itself to the ideal of the neoclassical, which is full employment equilibrium, where all people who want jobs, all resources that can be utilized are utilized. That's the model. Keynes says that's nonsense. In fact, you can exist at a low-level, non-full employment equilibrium for a long, long time. His famous phrase is that in the long run, we're all dead.
Right.
The question is, how do you get out of that low-level investment and that high unemployment that goes with the recession? Keynes, that what you do is that the government begins to spend – and the government spends in order to hand money to the to workers who will then consume.
To pump it up.
To pump up the economy. There had been, you know, acceptance of limited amount of pump priming before, but Keynes makes it this systematic, and he gives it a theoretical structure.
Galbraith is then the great champion of this view.
Galbraith is the great champion, but he goes further. He is a specific kind of Keynesian. Keynes doesn't look at the structure of the economy, in particular the emergence of the giant corporation, as having a particular effect on the way the economy functions. Galbraith says you can use Keynesian means to stimulate an economy that's lagging, but you have to be very careful in understanding the structure of the large corporation and its ability to manipulate the landscape and to manipulate the effect of Keynesianism. Now, what I would argue to this listener in Michigan is we've never left Keynesianism behind. We just are now practicing what the Economist magazine described Ronald Reagan as practicing 25 years ago, which is turbocharged Keynesianism.
So, Bob, you would agree with him that you'd say it's not the tax cuts, it's the deficits
Deficits that are the stimulus, because what the government is doing is going out and pumping vast quantities of money, $500 trillion a year right now, is going to get pumped into this economy. The striking thing about the inefficiencies of this economy is that even pumping that much free government money into it, you can't get to full employment. You still have over 5% unemployment.
Bob, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, I want to bring you in here. We're hearing tonight Richard Parker saying that there's a lot of consistencies behind some very different rhetoric. And yet there are strong arms on the wheel turning the nation's mind, it would seem to me, away from so much of what Galbraith laid out. Do you feel that turn? I mean, how can we not?
Well, I don't really myself. I mean, the latest poll shows that only 35% of the public agrees with the president's plan on Social Security, and the White House says they have 6 weeks to change that. So that tells me that at bottom, Americans are capable of saying, no, we like the program Franklin Roosevelt gave us, and we don't want to go in this new direction. Certainly, there are hands at the wheel, and certainly they're not turning it in a Galbraithian direction. But I do believe that experience is a teacher, and I think what happened, the Great Depression opened the way for Keynes, opened the way for the idea that government could play an active role on behalf of the individual in the economy. That had been resisted throughout our history. And I think that, in a sense, that experience will be and is probably in process of being repeated, because the environmental crisis, the bumping up of industrialism against the biosphere, this crisis cannot be dealt with without a substantial increase in the role of government, probably in all our lives.
But that reckoning won't come in a market crash.
Oh, no, but I think it's going to come. I think it's going to be a kind of crash. And slowly but surely, I think that experience will. Americans have the political culture tends to be conservative, and the crippling myths of individualism tend to prevent people from thinking of collective solutions. There's no way you can talk about the environmental crisis without collective solutions.
Crippling myths of individualism. Of course, many people ride on the fuel of individualism.
Well, I don't know. My comment on that would be the one that Charles Baird made about growing up in Illinois. He said, in the 19th century, he said, we were surrounded plenty of individuals. We heard a lot about them, but not about individualism. That has really been a kind of, smokescreen around big business throughout our history.
We see the difference there. Richard's calling from New York City. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you so much. Mm. A couple of things. One, to read John Kenneth Galbraith's books is to have the veil lifted from your eyes.
It can be pretty fabulous.
Mm. Secondly, you talked earlier about equations. For economists to use equations is to take the human cost out of economic policies. It's a way of obscuring reality, something that John Kenneth Galbraith illuminated rather than obscured. And lastly, to say that he's been on the margin, he's been annihilated by the right-wing control of the media. People with his views cannot get on the air except for NPR. So when Milton Friedman and those people and that ilk control the airwaves, we only hear that. And I don't think that's an accurate picture of what happens in the economy.
Richard, we've got great points all, and I have to point out, we've had them all here, from Milton Friedman to Galbraith himself, but thank you for your call. Let me get another call here. Chuck is calling from Sherburne, Massachusetts. Hi, Chuck. You're on the air.
Yes. I'd like to direct this mostly to Jack Beatty because I think he'd have a lot to say about it. I think that Galbraith at this point would be shaking his head in despair at the direction of this country, which is less and less able to effectively compete in the international market. But
Chuck, I'm told he's listening tonight, so
we can get a
reality check on that
later. Okay, well, John, I want to ask you something, Mr. Galbraith. Wouldn't you be amazed and delighted at how the European Union has progressed with a judicious mixture of government and business created a tremendously prosperous populace with tremendous potential for the future? They don't have the unemployment that we say they do. It's about equal to ours. They support entrepreneurial activity and successfully. They have much better antitrust enforcement. They were the only ones to stand up against Bill Gates and Jack Welch. They lack the corruptions in the market that we have, especially Northern Europe. There's more class mobility there. There's less crime.
So wouldn't
and they have
Mr.
a trade surplus.
We've got it. So wouldn't Mr. Galbraith look to Europe as maybe the model of where he would have liked things to go? We're going to ask Richard Parker to stand in here and answer, on, you know, as he might.
Absolutely would be his answer. He absolutely looks to Western Europe as a model that the United States can learn more from, just as he looks to Canada as a model from which the United States can learn.
But the Wall Street Journal tells us every day about eurosclerosis. They're in big trouble. They're so bound up in regulation. They don't have the growth America has. That's why this is still the great engine.
You know, the Wall Street Journal represents what Galbraith famously called the conventional wisdom, which is the collective understanding of the world that benefits the few rather than the many. We all live at all times under some degree or another of conventional wisdom, and those moments which are epoch-shaking, which change the world, are when the majority stand up against the dominant conventional wisdom of the time and say, this no longer coincides with my direct apprehension of the world in which I live. Now, the exhaustion of the political culture in the United States in the last 30 years rests directly on a particular failing of liberalism in the 1960s that can be captured in two words, the Vietnam War. What happened was that Galbraith recognized, as the Kennedy administration first began to dabble in Vietnam, that the risk of a war in Vietnam would derail not just the Kennedy administration, but the liberal wing of the Democratic Party and Keynesianism itself. He proved, tragically from his point of view, to be absolutely right. And with it came the destruction of confidence in government. And it has been the loss of confidence in government that has done such damage. But, of course, every one of those polls that points to lower confidence in government points to even lower confidence in big business.
Half a minute left. Do you see this country being pulled away from the legacy of the New Deal? Are we headed onto a whole new course in this new century? Or do you see us on or swinging back toward the Galbraith view?
I can't tell you whether we're going to swing back or not. I think that's history in the making. I think that at some point the American people, in a significant way, are going to say that what they've gotten in the last 30 years hasn't worked. In the first 30 years after the Second World War, their average after-tax, after-inflation incomes doubled. In the last 30 years, it's risen 5%. They have to make a choice about the world they want for their children.
Well, here's someone to read, two folks to read, as they do, Galbraith and all his works, and this new biography, weaving just a tremendous history of the 20th century right through the life of this enormous figure. Richard Parker, thank you for the book, and thank you for being with us tonight.
Delighted to be here with you.
The book is John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. Jack Beatty, wonderful to have you with us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can hear our full 2002 interview with John Kenneth Galbraith on our website, onpointradio.org. In a moment, Bill Gates calls for an overhaul of the American education system. This is On Point. calling American high schools obsolete and outdated, Microsoft chairman Bill Gates is pushing for a radical restructuring of the American education system. Speaking at an education summit co-sponsored by the National Governors Association over the weekend, Gates argued that two-thirds of high school students are not adequately being prepared for the challenges of life in the 21st century. To quote him, "If we keep the system as it is, millions of children will never get a chance to fulfill their promise because of their zip code, their skin color, or the income of their parents," he said. "That is offensive to our values, and it's an insult to who we are." Quoting Bill Gates, here's more of his speech.
America's high schools are obsolete. By obsolete, I don't just mean that they're broken or are flawed or underfunded, though a case could be made for every one of those points. By obsolete, I mean our high schools, even when they're working as designed, cannot teach all our students what they need to know today. Training the workforce of tomorrow with these high schools is like trying to teach kids about today's computers on a 50-year-old mainframe. It's the wrong tool for the times. Our high schools were designed 50 years ago to meet the needs of another age. Until we design them to meet the needs of this century, we will keep limiting and even ruining the lives of millions of Americans every year. Today, only one-third of students graduate from high school ready for college, work, and citizenship. One-third. The other two-thirds, most of them low-income and minority students, are tracked into courses that won't ever get them ready for college or prepare them for a family wage job, no matter how well the students learn or the teachers teach. This isn't a flaw in the system, it's part of the design of the system. In district after district, wealthy white kids are taught Algebra 2, while low-income kids are taught how to balance a checkbook. The first group goes on to college and career. The second group will struggle to make a living wage. Let's be clear. Thanks to dedicated teachers and principals around the country, the best educated kids in the United States are still the best educated kids in the world. We should be proud of that. But only a fraction of our kids are getting the best education. Once we realize that we're keeping low-income and minority kids out of rigorous courses, there can only be two arguments for keeping it that way. Either we think they can't learn, or we think they're not worth teaching. The first argument would be factually wrong, and the second would be morally wrong. Everyone who understands the importance of education, everyone who believes in equal opportunity, everyone who's been elected to uphold the obligations of public office should actually be ashamed that we are breaking our promise of a free education for millions of students. For the sake of these young people and everyone who will depend upon them, we must stop rationing education in America. When I compare our high schools to what I see when I'm traveling abroad, I'm terrified for our workforce of tomorrow. In math and science, our fourth graders are among the top students in the world. By eighth grade, they're in the middle of the pack. By 12th grade, United States students are scoring near the bottom of all industrialized nations. In 2001, India graduated a million more students from college than the United States. China graduates twice as many. And if we compare engineering degrees, China is graduating six times as many as the United States. In the international competition to have the best supply of knowledge workers, America is falling behind.
Microsoft Chairman Bill Gates speaking over the weekend at the National Education Summit on High Schools in Washington, D.C. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.
Support.